Thank you, Your Honor. It's Bradley Levine, bar number 13095, on behalf of the Lyonses. May it please the court. I am, I think the first place for us to start, and I have to tell you, I think it's sort of the beginning and the end of the analysis with respect to CTSI, and whether or not CTSI is in fact a public entity which is entitled to immunity under the Government's Immunity Act, has to start with the definition of a public entity pursuant to the statute. Which of course is found in CR section 2410.103 sub 5. And we have consistently gone through and talked about what that definition requires. And I have to tell you that from looking at the briefs that have been submitted by CTSI and in fact looking at the court order, the trial court order, it is unclear to us how it is that CTSI qualifies as a public entity pursuant to the statute. The statute is specifies, and we talk about in our briefs, we talked about that there are essentially three different ways that you can qualify as a public entity under the statute. It talks about, and the court can read the statute itself, it talks about, first of all, that a public entity is a state, county, city and county, municipality, school, district, special improvement district, and every other kind of district, agency, instrumentality, or political subdivision thereof, organized pursuant to law. What we have here is, we're in this stepping back, we know that CTSI...
Can I interrupt you for just one second? The part that you've just quoted...
Yes, Your Honor.
Is it your interpretation of the statute that the part that you've just quoted defines two ways that you could be a public entity under the statute?
No, what we just read defines, well, I mean, there are a couple of ways. Either in terms of being a public entity, you can either be a state, county, city, and county, municipality, school district, or special improvement district. Okay, you can be one of those. And then there's another way. You can be a district, agency, instrumentality, or political subdivision of one of those types of things.
So that's that two ways.
That is two different ways. That's true.
I'm trying to get at where you're ultimately going in terms of where the three ways are.
Yeah, exactly, Your Honor. So what we have is that that's a way, and what we did is we sort of lumped together, because what I was going to go towards is that the second part of the definition talks about a separate entity created by intergovernmental contract or cooperation only between, and has the same listing of different types of entities, if you will, a state, county, city, and county, municipality, school district, special improvement district, and then it has that same addition at the end, every other kind of district, agency, instrumentality, or political subdivision thereof. So that's why when we talk about three, we talk about either you're the state or the county or so on, or you are, because of an intergovernmental contract of cooperation, there may be a separate entity that's created. Or if what you have is you have an instrumentality, an agency, or political subdivision of what we've denominated in our briefs, either one or two.
Okay, so I've got a couple of questions about that then.
Yes, Your Honor.
Why isn't it then four ways that you could become
entity? We can call it four ways, but putting aside the numbers, the problem here has to do with the fact that CTSI doesn't qualify as any of those things, at least under any of the, you know, the definitions that are set forth in the statute. Because what we have is we've got the pool, and we have conceded the fact that the pool is a public entity. Okay.
Because why?
Because there are a couple of potential ways that it could be regarded as a public entity. It potentially is a special. What you have is a group of. It's basically a number of different districts, special improvement districts. So basically, it's acting as, if you will, an instrumentality of them, in the sense that what they're doing is that they're pooling their resources. And I think there's also a pretty good argument that what you have is that they have an intergovernmental contract. There's been a contract that's been submitted as part of the evidence. So we will basically concede for purposes of the argument here that the pool itself is a public entity under the statute. The problem comes with CTSI, because CTSI has been is what we're told, and there's been evidence that's been put forth by CTSI, that what they do is that they're essentially the manager, if you will, of insurance claims. And that's sort of a broad way of putting what they're doing, but they're basically handling the various kinds of claims that are submitted to the pool. They basically do the handling and the management, probably a certain modicum of decision making and so on behalf of the pool with respect to those claims. The problem is that it is that there's no provision whatsoever under the statute for, call it whatever you want, an instrumentality, if you will. Now, and I'll get to this in a minute, there's been some suggestion by CTSI, they talk about it being a political subdivision, and we'll get there in a minute. But again, they haven't really been very clear as to what it is that they're saying that they are, but let's say that it's an instrumentality. The problem is that if you have the pool, which is an instrumentality of, you know, the state or the counties or the districts, because it's a pooling the district. It's not a district itself. So even if it's an instrumentality of the districts, or if because of the fact that it is a contract, okay, in other words, that they've got, that they've been formed by these the contracts, okay, that the fact is that you don't have CTSI, there's no provision for it to be there, that you have a public entity which is an instrumentality of an instrumentality. That's the deficit, that's the problem, is it doesn't fit within any of the definitions under sub 5.
Let me follow through on that a little bit.
Sure.
And I recognize that this isn't the rationale that the trial court used, but why isn't, under what clearly appear to be undisputed facts, why isn't CTSI itself a separate entity that's created by intergovernmental cooperation? Because it's crystal clear that it was created by, and it's managed and controlled by, a bunch of counties. Why aren't they a separate entity created by intergovernmental cooperation of different public entities, counties? I mean, that's what the documents say.
Well, the document talks about, let's put aside what we're talking as far as the document. I understand that you've got this document. The problem here, though, is that what we're talking about is, for purposes of this case, we're talking about the pool. Okay, and you're talking about the fact that they are managing claims that are submitted under a contract that is issued by the pool. It has nothing to do with any action by the county. In other words, I suppose that in another circumstance, if what they were doing is that they were acting on behalf of the county or separate or several counties for some purpose, that there may be an argument that they would be essentially an instrumentality for the county. The point, though, is that we're talking here about an insurance policy that is issued by a pool. In other words, that pool consists of a number of different, if you will, special districts that, pursuant to their agreement, are undertaking certain kinds of functions. In this case, we're talking about providing insurance coverage, okay?
Insurance coverage, though, special districts of not just this pool, but several pools that are literally part of the counties. I mean, that's how I read the documents. The counties created CTSI to be, as you said, kind of the manager and administer the claims for these various insurance pools and for the counties individually. That's what the documents say.
Well, it talks about, in terms of, again, it talks about intergovernmental cooperation between them. There's no case that I've seen that, you know, that talks about what it is that we're talking about here. Again, the way that that document is structured is supposed to be essentially what CTSI is doing is it's providing services, in this case, on behalf of the pool. Okay, and so for that purpose, for the poor, you know, and that, by the way, is another issue which I don't know that there's any Colorado appellate court case that talks about that, which is that potentially, and that's what I was trying to get at, is that for certain purposes, for example, for providing certain services on behalf of the counties, it may be considered to be a public entity for that purpose. The point here, though, is that, and it's a technical argument that we're talking about here, but the point is that if you have a pool, which in this case, what's going on is CTSI is performing these kinds of services for this pool of various counties. And in that instance, for the purposes of this case, we do not believe that CTSI is a governmental entity. Now, we also
Pardon me for interrupting you, Mr. Levine, if I may, sir. Please. Let's take Judge Loeb to an extra step. Assume for purposes of argument, I understand that these are hypothetical facts, but assume for purposes of argument that CTSI is, let's say, Montezuma County.
That if CTSI is the county.
Yes, is Montezuma County. Montezuma County says we're going to put together this group of people. They're county employees. They work for us. And they're going to do this administration. Do you have the same response to that?
No, I don't.
Okay. What's the difference then?
Well, the difference is that in this, you're saying the county is performing the function of
CTSI.
Of CTSI. In other words, well, I do have the same response because there's no provision in the statute for saying that a governmental entity is, even if you have the governmental entity itself, which is the county itself, which is performing the services, well, because in that case, if it is in fact the county that's performing the services itself, even if it's the county that's performing the services on behalf of the pool, the county specifically would constitute a public entity. I mean, because it's defined that way. And I gather that if the court were to find that if in fact it's that it's a separate entity created by intergovernmental contract or cooperation, again, the issue, and this is, again, it gets very technical. The issue is whether or not if what it's doing is that it's performing this type of service, and that service is on behalf of another governmental entity. The question is whether or not it falls within the aegis of the statute.
And to get to that precise question, isn't that when you would look at cases like Robinson and Moran and others to see whether it's really public rather than private?
Yeah, no problem, Your Honor. And let me just get to that, because obviously that's what the trial court relied on. Merely because of the fact that if you have Moran and you have in the Robinson case that they're talking about those being private corporations, merely because this is not a private corporation doesn't necessarily mean that it is suddenly a public corporation, that suddenly it takes on, because it's a public corporation under a different statute, that suddenly it becomes a political subdivision or it suddenly becomes a public entity. The exclusion of one doesn't mean
I understand that, but you still have to look at the statute. But it seems to me when you have an entity like CTSI, you've additionally got to look at those cases and the tests that they articulate to see where they fit within that as well.
And Your Honor, I'm glad that you brought that up, because the other point is that the question at the end of the day is whether or not it's governmental in nature, because that's what those cases talk about. And what we would suggest is that when you're talking about handling of insurance claims, that in and of itself is not inherently governmental, intrinsically governmental type of activity. Obviously, insurance claim handling is something which is done all the time by its public and whoever it may be. It is not inherently governmental, and that's what the Robinson case talks about, and that's what the Moran case talk about. I would like to very quickly, obviously we've got other arguments that even if this is found to be a governmental entity, that Mr. Fader's letter, we believe, comes within the falls within the aegis of it was adequate notice. It substantially complied with the notice statute, so that both these entities had notice. And then the other argument that we've talked about is we believe that it's appropriate for this court to look at the decision by another panel in the Jordan case, that insurance bad faith cases are all grounded in contract. In other words, you cannot have an insurance bad faith case without a contractual relationship, and therefore the GAI is not going to apply to a bad faith claim. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time if I could.
And I know you've got just a few seconds, but I just want to make sure I understand your position with respect to notice, because in your reply brief, you seem to make it pretty clear that were we to rule against you on whether number one, this was a tort claim that was covered by the Governmental Immunity Act, and two, that these entities were public entities, the notice issue was moot, and we wouldn't, and indeed shouldn't, have to address it. That's what you say in your reply brief, and I want to understand where you are.
Yeah, exactly. And I very frankly, as I was preparing for oral argument, I looked at that, and I don't think we were absolutely clear about things. I think that at the end of the day, if these are governmental entities, that if there are claims here, that notice issue is an issue that this court does need to look at. The question of whether or not we substantially complied with the statute.
Well, if they're governmental entities and this is a tort covered by the GIA, why is notice relevant?
That's true. I mean, obviously, if it's a tort claim, that if it doesn't come within one of the exceptions, then we don't have any kind of valid claim to pursue. The point, though, is that to the extent to which you don't have the statute applying, to this claim, in other words, it's a breach of contract claim, then we would suggest that we did give adequate notice under the statute that Mr. Fader's letter substantially complied pursuant to the Feeney case.
Mr. Levine, I messed you up in terms of your timing. You had about 45 seconds when I ungraciously interrupted you, so I'd ask the bailiff to give you that 45 seconds for rebuttal if you need it.
May it please the court, good afternoon. My name is Jander Nathan, registration number 3295. Let's talk about the public nature of CTSI, because it's our contention it is both an instrumentality and a political subdivision. It is a public corporation. It is owned by public entities. It is created by public entities. It serves only public entities. It is managed and controlled solely by public entities. Its assets are owned only by governmental entities, and it is solely funded by governmental entities. The reason it was set up is because there are multiple pools that were set up for the counties. And rather than have, and the counties have no, pools have no employees. So rather than have duplicative services, the CTSI was set up to provide those services only to governmental entities and to avoid a lack of efficiency.
Let me ask you a question. So you say it is formed by governmental entities.
Yes.
So if it is formed by governmental entities, would it be a separate entity under the statute?
It would be both an instrumentality and a separate subdivision, because there's a statute that defines political subdivisions as public corporations.
So if it is, what's the difference between a separate entity and an instrumentality?
Well, I think they're both separate entities. Mm-hmm. I'm saying that it's covered twice in the Governmental Immunity Act definition of public entity. It is both an instrumentality and a political subdivision.
But what's it an instrumentality of?
It's an instrumentality of governmental entities, which are the pools, which are governmental entities and conceded, and this court has held that they're governmental entities, Kratzer versus Sirsa. And so it's a instrumentality of those pools and the counties which they serve, and it's also a public corporation, which by statute makes it a political subdivision.
Okay, I've got two questions about that. First of all, what's the statute that makes a public corporation a political subdivision?
29-1202.
Now, you said if it's an instrumentality, it's an instrumentality of the pool. Would you fit that argument for me into the actual language of the statute defining public entity? Because I don't see the use of the word pool in there.
It says any separate entity created by cooperation between or among any other kind of instrumentality or political subdivision. And the definition, as I said, of political subdivision is a public corporation formed by cooperation between governmental entities. And 29-1201 says that the Constitution of this state encourages the formation of those types of entities to provide for efficient services to the public, which is what CTSI does. And it says that to that end, that statute is to be liberally construed. So CTSI does nothing more than, as this court pointed out in questions to Mr. Levine, does nothing more than simply take the role of what county employees would do or pool employees would do. Now, there's cases like Aurora versus Jordan where the court dealt with whether or not the claim of bad faith breach of insurance contract was a tort. But Aurora is self-insured. It does its own things. Montezuma County may be self-insured. I don't know. Certainly Denver and other government entities that are self-insured perform these very functions for themselves. And there's no difference in taking it out of that context and putting it into a corporation that solely performs these functions. The Colorado Association of Public Employees versus Regents case is the case that we contend is on point. And in that case, the Supreme Court had to decide what a nonprofit corporation that University Hospital had been changed into was in terms of whether it was a public entity or not. Different context, but still the question is it a public entity? And the court said, okay, it performs the functions of government. It's controlled by government, the regents, and therefore it's a public corporation. And CTSI meets that same criteria. It's a governmental source of services with an actual control by governments. And its purpose is to promote the efficiency of government. So we contend that under the decision in the Regents case, it's clear that CTSI is a public corporation, and under 29.1.202, it is therefore a political subdivision. But if you go on to the definition in the CJIA, we start with Robinson that says, look, the central legislative purpose of the CJIA is to limit the potential liability of public entities for compensatory money damages and tort. All the funding for CTSI comes from taxpayers. And CTSI, as I indicated, is an entity created by cooperation by or between instrumentalities and political subdivisions, and is a political subdivision. We contend that statutory definitions of public entity and political subdivisions are quite broad. Cooperation of this sort is encouraged. It's based on a constitutional provision, according to 29.1.201, which says it's to implement the constitutional provision about cooperation. Even the plaintiff's argument, which is that there are three levels, we would fall into the third level. There's nothing about three levels in any of the statutes, but even if you took their argument and you looked at the three levels they say exist, we would fall under the third one, an entity created by intergovernmental cooperation. When the status of CTSI has previously been analyzed, there had been no dispute. The Internal Revenue Service analyzed whether it was a public entity and found that it was, and it used factors which are very similar to the type of factors which the courts use to decide whether entities are public or not. And PARA, which by state statute can only accept political subdivisions and public entities into its fund, has decided that it is a public entity. So there's no real dispute in our opinion. Now, if you take the Texaco Corporation and the Standard Insurance Company in the Robinson and Moran cases, there's a clear distinction. Those are private companies that merely contract for services with a government to supply. They supply services to private entities. They have their own structure that's private. Completely different here. The Robinson case said, look at any liability that's imposed upon Texaco is going to be paid by Texaco, not a governmental entity. That's not the case here. Any liability imposed on CTSI is paid by taxpayer funds for governmental entities. So we believe that under any construction, CTSI is a public entity. The next step then is to ask whether or not bad faith breach of insurance contract is a tort. Now, the two cases that established that claim in Colorado are Trimble and Savio in 1984 and 1985. And if you read those cases, they repeatedly referred to the claim as a tort. In fact, the Trimble case described that claim as a tort on at least 10 occasions, and the Savio case more than that. Now, it's unreasonable to assume that the Supreme Court would have chosen its terms and used them repeatedly so carelessly. But every other case that's discussed that in Colorado, every other case that has discussed the claim of bad faith breach of insurance contract has described it as a tort. It's a tort characterized by negligence or unreasonable conduct, which is tortious, and it arises out of a separate duty imposed by law, not out of the insurance contract itself. Brodeur, a case that we cited, and Cork, another case we cited, discussed this in terms of what statute of limitations governs a bad faith claim. Both of them held it was the two-year tort statute, not the three-year contract statute. And Carruthers, the court said, look, at even if there's contract, if an action sounds in tort, it's a tort under the CGIA. And then we have Leeper and FAM, which is federal and state cases, one from this court, that said bad faith claims sound in tort, and they exist independently of the liability imposed by an insurance contract, which is the sine qua non of whether or not it's a contract claim or a tort claim. And finally, we have this court ruling in Jordan on the direct point. Bad faith breach is a claim that lies in tort, and it's barred by the Governmental Immunity Act against the City of Aurora. Plaintiffs cite no contrary authority that I am aware of that says it's not a tort. Every case says it is. And even if it wasn't, it's something that could lie in tort. I mean, that's the distinction, too, because the act is even broader than lies in tort. It's lies in tort or could lie in tort. I would like to mention something that there was mentioned in the reply brief by the Lions, and that is that they should have been permitted to do discovery on the CGIA. Discovery and a Trinity hearing are things that are allowed and probably should occur if there's a factual issue. The plaintiffs assert, however, that the only question they have is has there been a deliberate waiver by resolution under 104 of the Immunity Act, which requires a written resolution passed by the governing board. And we have an affidavit that says there is no such resolution, and they have no evidence to the contrary. So therefore, there is no need for discovery on an issue that is clear and undisputed. There is no need to delay and have a Trinity hearing and raise the cost of this case. The trial court was correct in ruling based upon the briefs because there is no factual dispute on the 104 waiver issue. Finally, the Lions threw in the reply brief something about attorney's fees under 1317-201. The only claim against CTSI is a bad faith claim. If that claim is dismissed under governmental immunity, then CTSI is entitled to its attorney's fees. This is not a case where a contract claim is pled, but it's really a tort claim. This is a claim, if you read their counterclaim, where they plead a tort and separate independent duty imposed by law. And therefore, at least as the CTSI, we believe attorney's fees are warranted.
Would you agree that there are no attorney's fees to be warranted for the pool because there is still existing a breach of contract claim against them?
You know, I've been told this many times. It's never happened to me. I've been told that if I don't need to use all my time, I shouldn't. I have no further statements to make. If there's no questions, I'll sit down.
Mr. Nathan. Mr. Levine, if you want it, you got about 45 seconds.
Very quickly, 3 points. One is that The definition under 29.1202 of a political subdivision refers to a public corporation organized pursuant to law. Now, I don't know of any case that tells us what that means in terms of organized pursuant to law. There hasn't been anything that has been, that I've seen in the briefs that have been submitted by CTSI indicating that it is a public corporation organized pursuant to law. Second is that I would urge the court to look at exactly what the evidence is in terms of what it is that the CTSI does, because it indicates that it has the purpose. If you look at the letter from Sherman and Howard that's attached to the affidavit, and if you look at the bylaws, we don't know if this was organized by the counties. All that we know is that it has to do with the insurance pools and doing something on behalf of the insurance pools. And the final thing has to do with in terms of under the Smith case, and as far as the attorney's fees, I would make 2 points. Number one is that there was no request for attorney's fees on behalf of CTSI in the trial court. Number two, with respect to CTSI, I think you need to look at the statute itself that it talks about when there's been a claim against a defendant. Here we have a third party that's involved, a third party claim. And the other aspect of it is that if they're saying this is on behalf of the pool, in other words, that they're an instrumentality or an agent or somehow acting on behalf of the pool, the fact that we still have a breach of contract claim against the pool means that the entire action, even as to CTSI, even though the claims against CTSI might be gone if the court agrees with their position, we still have an ongoing claim against the pool, and we have CTSI in the position of acting on their behalf. So we don't believe that under these circumstances, reading the statute 1317.101 narrowly as it should be, that's appropriate to award attorney's fees.
Thank you, Mr. Levine. All right, I'll let counsel take a breather, and whenever you're ready, I guess the roles are reversed in the next case. There's certainly no need to change tables. We'll hear argument in 2011 CA 312, which is the duty to defend case.
You are ready?
Set.
May it please the court, Your Honor. My name is Marnie Nathan Closter, registration number 34947. As much as the Lions would like to frame this case as a typical insurance case, it simply is not. This matter involves an underlying case where there is no allegation in the four corners of the complaint which implicates coverage by the self-insurance pool. And even if there somehow were such allegations, the district court in the underlying case has absolutely no jurisdiction to hear them, as they are barred under the Colorado Governmental Immunity Act and particularly the notice requirements found in CRS 2410-109. The jurisdictional issue and its bar to any potentially covered claims is a novel but nonetheless important issue which we need court clarification on. Here, the fact that there are no covered claims in the underlying La Plata County District Court case could easily be confirmed by the Lions filing a motion to dismiss under the Colorado Governmental Immunity Act, just as the Lincoln Creek Metropolitan District did when it was brought in on a third-party complaint.
So let me ask you a couple of questions about that. And the other so-called extrinsic evidence facts that you talk about in your briefs. Under HECLA and its progeny, how do we have any ability to look at that stuff? All we're supposed to look at, as I understand the test, is the language of the underlying complaint.
And there are a number of cases that focus on the underlying complaint and the four corners of that document. There is a case, Pompa, which references that there's a belief that the Supreme Court would allow review of extrinsic evidence in certain circumstances. And whether you look at only the four corners of the complaint in this case, as HECLA identified, or you take it to the extreme and you look at the extrinsic evidence, the bottom line is there is no basis for coverage. Not only is there no allegations which provide a basis for coverage in the complaint, but even if they did try, or you read into them that they provided a basis for coverage, then those claims are all tort claims. All four of the claims pled in the underlying complaint are tort claims or claims that lie in tort. There is no allegation pled in the underlying complaint that there was proper compliance with the notice statute under 2410-109. And that is a jurisdictional prerequisite.
Now, we had hoped that maybe the district court would, on its own motion in the last 3 years, take action to determine that there was, in fact, no jurisdiction to continue to hear any claims based upon the Lions' actions as district board members, if there were such allegations. But unfortunately, in the last 3 years, the court has not done that. And the Lions have done nothing to bring that issue to a forefront and to make the court rule on jurisdiction.
I mean, I realize that you talk about you're in a bit of a bind here, that if there was, if we were to hold that there was a duty to defend, that you would kind of be out in the blue. But don't you really have options? Can't you move to intervene in the underlying case? Can't you say that the Lions have breached their failure to cooperate under the insurance policy and try to deal with that in this action? Don't you have some avenues to deal with that?
Your Honor, if you give us that authority, we will absolutely pursue any of the other options. But our concern is, with a bad faith claim pending and a breach of contract claim pending, if we take these actions and somehow it's determined later that, you know, there was something else out there that we should have done in lieu of just cutting off a defense, that we're going to be held liable. So we filed this DEC action for that purpose, because while we know anticipatory declaratory judgment actions are not preferred, in this situation, we had two components to it, one of which was this duty to defend, which we believe, given the immunity issues, was something, and the member issues, was something that could easily be resolved by the court without having to implicate any sort of wrongdoing or discuss the actual merit of the claims of fraud and misrepresentation, which is why they don't like anticipatory.
What jurisdiction do we have to rule on it's essentially the merits, whether they can proceed as a matter of substance in the underlying case? It's not the case from which we have this appeal. So why do we have any jurisdiction to deal with those issues?
I believe you have jurisdiction to identify that not only are there no allegations in the complaint which provide a duty to defend, but even if they were, they are jurisdictionally barred, and therefore there is no duty to defend. The law requires, specifically it was Pompa who indicated, that a duty to defend only applies when there is a potential for ultimate liability on the party. If there is in fact immunity, which there is, for any claims that could have been asserted against the Lions in their capacity as district board members, since all four claims lie in tort, then there can be absolutely no potential for liability as members of the district board for which there would be coverage under the insurance certificate.
That hasn't been briefed to us. I mean, you may be right, but I'm still struggling with why we are in a position to decide that when that issue isn't in front of us, and it hasn't been, it's not part of this case.
Well, I think it has been briefed, Your Honor. I mean, the focus of our briefing was twofold in this court, one of which is that there's no allegations in the underlying complaint, and in fact, a number of facts which weigh in favor of there being no allegations against the Lions in their capacity as district board members, but also this issue of immunity exists.
I understand the argument.
So if you look at solely the four corners of the underlying complaint, there are a number of pieces of evidence which show there is no basis for a duty to defend, and therefore specifically no allegations that the Lions acted in their capacity as members as required in order for the self-insurance pool to provide coverage. Specifically, there's the lack of CGIA notice being pled. The allegations are of reckless and intentional conduct, at least as associated with fraud, which would be willful and wanton under the CGIA, and again, outside the scope of coverage. The Lions are the only district board members named, and the district itself was not named as a party. Clearly, if the actions were based upon the district or authorized actions on behalf of the district, you would presume that people other than just the developers would be named. The Lions Development Company, LCV, was named, as were the Lions. LCV is specifically identified and referred to as the developer, and the Lions are specifically identified and repeatedly referred to as developer defendants.
Let me ask you a question about that also. And that's the fact that you just referred to, that in the underlying complaint, in the identifying section, the Lions basically says we're going to talk about them in addition to LCV as developer defendants.
Correct.
So my question is this. Is there any case that tells us how we're supposed to evaluate that particular fact? Or is it your argument that that's dispositive, or that it's just something that we throw into the mix in looking at all the allegations in the complaint, including the underlying facts of what supposedly the Lyons's did wrong? And is there any case law that helps us in terms of how we evaluate how a particular defendant is identified in the complaint itself?
I would love to say I am aware of a specific case that says how they're identified is dispositive. And there may be a case out there. I'm not aware standing here today of one. However, even if you take it from the more broader perspective of under HECLA and the other cases, and you say, we're going to look at all the facts that are in the complaint, that at least is one fact. And I believe a key fact, because there's not also an allegation that the Lyons are authorized members of the district and acting in their capacity, and so we'll identify them as district defendants when it has to do with their district actions and developer defendants for their developer actions. I mean, there's no doubt that the underlying complaint was artfully pled, and it was pled to try and create just this dilemma that the pool is facing, which is an allegation by the Lyons that they want coverage, but clearly no intent to comply with the Colorado Governmental Immunity Act by pleading notice or by pleading claims that they can actually prevail on. So the underlying plaintiffs must want this dilemma, and that's why they specifically pled it this way. But in addition to repeatedly calling them the developer defendants, the allegations which specifically lead to the claims for things like fraud and misrepresentation all have to do with the Lyons' actions specifically as developers. Things like providing projections for their development, providing information about the development loan that LCV obtained. These are not things about the district and how the district operates. These are things about how LCV and the Lyons as developers acted and projected.
Go ahead.
Well, it looks like the Lyons may be wearing two hats, though. So if their actions are in connection with the offer and sale of the bonds, how do you separate them out into developer versus district member?
Because you look at what the allegations are with respect to those actions, and here everything has to do with the development. As I said, there is plenty of information in the preliminary limited offering memorandum and the follow-up memorandum about the district and how it operates and how it was established. There's no allegations about fraud or misrepresentation with respect to those items.
But the allegations are that the offering memorandum contained misrepresentations or omitted certain important information, and that's a district. How do you deal with the trial court's rationale that that's a district document, and to the extent that the Lyons are implicated in helping to put that document together, which they clearly are in the complaint, and that's a factual issue to be determined at trial, why aren't those allegations against the Lyons's in their capacity as district directors?
Because they're, with respect to action that they would have provided as the developer, there's no dispute in the record, as far as I'm concerned, about whether the Lyons provided that information on behalf of LCV, and it was then incorporated into the offering memorandum. Again, there's no allegation that the district itself, other than relying on the information provided by the developers, acted inappropriately. There's also no allegation that as a district board member, not the developer, not the owner and entity responsible for LCV, that the Lyons provided this information or engaged in the fraud. There is plenty of allegations solely related to the district that there is no allegations of fraud.
Ms. Kloster, if I may interrupt, please. I'm having trouble wrapping my head around something, and maybe you can help me. And maybe I just have a limited view, but I'm having trouble understanding why, if the Lyons have what you characterize as a get-out-of-jail-free card, i.e., we're immune, you can't touch us, why they wouldn't have raised that and gotten this done if it's as clear-cut as you say? If it's simply saying, okay, we're out, and they're out, all right. But isn't it a little bit more complicated than that?
No, I think it's just that easy, and I can't speak for the Lyons, but I can tell you what I assume is the rationale, which is that because once they file that motion and the court goes, you're right, we have no jurisdiction over any claims asserted against you as authorized district representatives, then guess what happens? The plaintiffs go, well, yeah, because everything else that still exists, that's against you as individuals, and they don't have insurance coverage for that. So they would much prefer to be in this dilemma situation where we are forced to defend them. Because once that clarity is reached, there is no defense. There is absolutely no basis for them claiming a defense.
See, you said they don't have insurance coverage. How do we know that? That's not in the record.
Well, what you know is that they would not have insurance coverage under the pool's certificate.
Well, I understand that, but I mean, maybe they've got other insurance company coverage. I mean, there are all kinds of facts that I just don't know how we can grapple with those, because either they're not in front of us or we don't have the ability to decide the issue. That's the underlying trial court that's supposed to decide that.
Right, but we have an underlying trial court who is continuing to hear a case for which it does not have jurisdiction.
Why don't you
Well, Your Honor, if you can tell us a way that you believe we can do so legally, we are more than happy to do that. Unless there are specific questions, I would reserve the remainder for rebuttal.
Thank you, Counsel. You've got about 2 minutes.
May it please the Court, Bradley Levine on behalf of the Lions. The questions that the panel put to counsel were very appropriate, and I think that they disclose real problem as far as the position that has been taken here, but, and certainly something that the trial court perceived as well. The difficulty is that in terms of their position is that the question of whether or not there's a duty to provide a defense is to be determined solely based upon the pleadings. And what they're talking about, when you get into motives, reasons, things that could happen, should happen, they would like to have happen so that they can avoid whatever kind of insurance coverage, potentially, depending upon what happens, all these myriad of different scenarios and questions and whys and wherefores have absolutely nothing to do with the question of whether or not the pool is duty-bound, pursuant to its insurance policy, to provide a defense in the underlying case, which is what they're doing. They are providing that defense, and of course they filed a declaratory judgment action asking the court to declare that they don't have a duty to defend or to indemnify, but the upshot of it is that they are duty-bound based upon the allegations that were in the complaint. And at the hearing, Judge Cross, the underlying trial judge, heard all of the arguments and made what we believe are very complete findings, going through all the various pleadings and demonstrating that, in fact, there were allegations that were being made against the Lionses in their capacities as members of the district.
So let me interrupt you. Let's talk about that some.
Sure.
The underlying complaint. There's no question that the complaint, in terms of the identifying paragraph, says, okay, we're gonna identify these guys as developer defendants, and that's the name that we're going to give them throughout the complaint.
Sure.
But it goes farther than that, and it actually says they were acting in their capacity or on behalf of LCV, the developer. So the complaint never makes a similar express allegation with respect to them acting on behalf of the district. So how do we deal with that?
Well, with respect, Your Honor, they do talk about the fact, you know, certainly in one of the preliminary paragraphs, as you pointed out, they indicate that they're acting on behalf of LCV. You're correct about that. But if you look at throughout the complaint, for example, and this is what the trial judge pointed out as he walked through the complaint and made his determinations, if you look at paragraph 13, the very last sentence says that defendants Lions 3 and Lions Jr. and the relatives and business associates constituted all the members of the board of directors of the district and served as the district's management. And then as you go through in the various allegations, and as Your Honor pointed out, we've got the PLOM. That PLOM was the primary basis, as Judge Cross found, is this was all about the bonds. It had to do with the offering and going to the banks and saying, here, you should buy these bonds, which of course were bonds that were issued by the district. And the allegation and the basis for these claims is principally based upon what they said were misrepresentations that were made in the PLLM and in the various offerings that were made, the documents that were prepared by the Lionses on behalf of the district. And if you look at paragraph 45, which is in the first claim for relief, which is for the securities violation, it says that each the developer defendant, so it uses that terminology, as you say, which is just a moniker. And to answer the question that you asked of counsel, you know, I don't know that there's any case that says that merely because of the way that you denominate a particular party in a complaint that somehow that's dispositive of what their capacity is. You know, obviously it was it's a term that was used by the plaintiffs, and again, that's getting into a lot of things. You know, why'd you do that? Why'd you call them that? Whatever. It has absolutely nothing to do with the question of whether or not there's a defense responsibility. But in any event, it uses the term, each of the developer defendants is a person who directly or indirectly controlled the district or another person or entity who offered or sold the bonds to the plaintiffs at the time of such offers and sales. So again, Judge Cross, that was one of, you know, what he found to be, you know, pretty important, which is that, again, what you're doing is you're identifying the Lyonses and saying that these are folks who are acting on behalf of the district at the time that they went ahead and prepared the PLOM, and that PLOM, which was, of course, in conjunction with the sales of these bonds, and that they say that there's a lot of misleading statements and violations of securities laws and so on. So the upshot of it is that we understand that some of the initial allegations in the complaint, when they're talking about identifying who the parties are and so on, that they talk about the Lyonses on behalf of LCV in their developer capacity. But if you look at the complaint, the various allegations throughout, paragraph 34 talks about it and so on, that they do identify the, quote, developer defendants, or in certain instances, the Lyonses, as part of their actions on behalf of the district. So the long story short is that, as Judge Cross found, that there were a number of different allegations in the complaint that talk about the Lyonses in that capacity, and therefore, as such, that there were obligations that the pool was duty-bound pursuant to the insurance contract to provide a defense to the claims.
Let me ask a question about this immunity issue. I think I agree that the issue of whether the Lyonses have filed a motion to dismiss in the underlying case is extrinsic, and we probably can't get into that. But just looking at the allegations in the complaint, are we also allowed to look at what wasn't alleged in the complaint? For example, the argument that the other side makes is, well, there's no allegation whatsoever that notice was given under the CGIA. Now, we can look at the complaint and nothing else and determine that. And isn't that some evidence that the plaintiffs did not intend their allegations to be against the Lyonses in their capacity as district board members?
Your Honor, I understand the court's question. And I can just tell the court that I think that at the point at which you are asking that we look at what was not in a complaint in order for us to decide whether or not there's a defense responsibility, which is what I hear, because that's the only question before this court. It's not a question of whether or not there's immunity, not immunity, and so on. The only question that was before the trial court and this court is reviewing is whether or not there was a duty to defend. And there's no case that I'm aware of, and I have to tell you, this is, you know, area of law that I know a fair amount of cases in this state and across the country that say anything about, you know, well, we look to see what's not there. And I would suggest that that would be sort of a rather slippery slope, because I think that at the point at which what you're doing is that you're looking at what's not pled in a pleading, and somehow ascertaining whether or not there was a duty to defend on that basis, that really, in some senses, is pretty extrinsic in and of itself, because now you're asking, well, why didn't you do it? Why didn't you put this in there? Why isn't that part and parcel of the claims for relief that you were seeking? At the minute that you're doing that, you're now getting into a lot of hypothesizing and speculating as to what it is that was in the mind of the pleader at the time that the pleading was drafted. There's no case that I'm aware of any place that says that we're going to measure the duty to defend based upon what's not in the pleading. In other words, to say that, well, maybe what's in there says that you do, but because you didn't say this, well, that indicates that there are a lot of defenses. And by the way, that's an important point, too, is that, you know, you got to raise the defense, okay? In other words, just merely, you know, they're just supposing, and I don't think we need to go anywhere close to this, but the bottom line really is that even if they have this immunity and they say there's no jurisdiction or anything like that, the first thing is it's got to be raised. I mean, obviously, it's like anything else. A party who doesn't raise what is an affirmative defense means that, you know, it's not something that's going to be ruled on. And it never has been. And, of course, Judge Lopez, you've indicated that's not anything that's before this court because it just has never come up. So the upshot of it is, and I would suggest the answer to your question is no. I don't think that that's appropriate thing to do, to look beyond this as to what is not alleged in the complaint. So at the bottom, I could, spend the time and, walk our way through the various, allegations in the complaint. I think that Judge Cross did a very good job of that. He was very thorough in terms of going through and demonstrating all the allegations in the complaint that indicate that there were claims that was in their capacity as members of the district and that there's no need for us to do that. As to the question of, whether or not, the courts in this state have been very clear about not looking at extrinsic evidence, but as we pointed out, there are cases, the Heckler case, we talked about the fact that there have been cases where the courts have in fact looked the case involving the third and the fourth party complaints, where the courts have looked beyond just simply what was in there. Heckler was a case where they looked both at the claims as well as the third party complaints.
But in both of the cases that you cite, didn't they look at those third party complaints because those were pleadings against the very insureds who were trying to get coverage, and that we don't have that here.
I agree, Your Honor, but at the same time, the other pleadings can inform. My only point is it's not extrinsic evidence per se. In other words, it's part and parcel of the pleadings, so you certainly could if you needed to, and you don't need to, and that's what Judge Cross ultimately determined. You don't need to be looking at the third-party complaint in order to find that there was a duty to defend here. I'm just simply responding to the point that, certainly the third-party complaint just simply helps to inform the process. And by the way, just realizing it's not a Colorado appellate court decision, but one case that the court may be interested in looking at is the Anko versus Nutmeg case, which is a Tenth Circuit case, which is found at 593F3rd 1188. This is something that Tenth Circuit, as an aside, has just been wrestling with. Counsel made reference to the Pompey case. We've got the Anko case. There's another case, which, by the way, says you can't look at extrinsic evidence that came after the Anko case, called United Fire and Casualty versus Boulder Plaza Residential. It's 663F3rd 951.
Are any of these cases in the briefs?
Certainly the Pompey case is cited there. And I can't recall whether or not AMCO was cited in there. But in any event, in the AMCO case, the court, that was a case where there were a number of different pleadings which had been filed against the same party involving the same types of claims. And the court, which was trying to predict what the Supreme Court of Colorado would eventually said, the court held that an insurer cannot view the allegations contained in a single complaint in isolation when it is aware of multiple complaints arising from a common core of operative facts have been filed against the insured. Rather, the insurer must consider such complaints in conjunction to make a good faith determination of its duty to defend. So there they're talking just about multiple complaints. And my only point, though, is that the third-party complaint, I don't believe, and I think that that's what the Heckler case indicates, is that it's not something which is quote-unquote extrinsic. It's something that certainly a court could consider as part and parcel of determining whether or not the complaint against the Lions is in fact invoked, created a duty to defend. I guess I'm going to take my lead from Mr. Nathan. Unless the court has any other questions, I'll sit down.
Thank you, Mr. Levine.
Thank you.
Kloster, before you begin, whatever rebuttal you have, there've been at least a couple of federal cases cited to us, which I haven't gone back and looked, but apparently they're not in the briefs. Would you like to respond to those now, or would you like some time to file something with us in response to those, or do you care?
Well, I'll look at the Anko case. I did not see that was cited in the brief, and I have not read that recently, so I wouldn't be prepared to respond, but if appropriate, we'll file a supplement.
Why don't we do this? If you want to file something, why don't you file something within 5 business days of today, no longer than 3 pages, and you can do it by letter addressed to all members of the panel, if you would.
Thank you, Your Honor.
No obligation to, but if you want to, if you can follow those guidelines, obviously a copy to Mr. Levine as well.
Yes, Your Honor. In response, Judge Loeb, to your question about the lack of notice being pled in the underlying complaint, I believe the case law actually says that you should consider that lack of notice as dispositive. I would cite to the court United States v. Security Management Company, 96 F3rd 260, which was a Seventh Circuit case, which said when allegations of something such as a physical malady must be found within the four corners of the complaint for there to be a proper claim alleged, and the complaint is silent, then the complaint is found not to trigger a duty to defend. I would also point the court to Deason v. Lewis, 706 P. 2nd, 1283, and Aspen Orthopedics versus Aspen Valley Hospital, 353 F. 3rd, 832, which all discuss that pleading of compliance with CGIA notice is an actually required step in a complaint, and that dismissal for that lack of pleading in and of itself is an appropriate course of action.
Are these cases all in the briefs?
Yes, they are.
Okay, thank you.
I would also note that this court has jurisdiction to advise the pool under a declaratory judgment action of how we handle the issue of the duty to defend. You have that right, and you have that right to tell us, you're right, there is no allegations which have been properly pled that could survive and that for which there is jurisdiction that you need to defend. And that's all we're asking for in this case, Your Honor. As for Judge Cross, he relied on the third-party complaint, which if he's limited to the four corners of the complaint, that was inappropriate, because the third-party complaint alleged no claims, as Your Honor mentioned, against the Lions, unlike the cases where third-party complaints were the actual subject of the request for coverage.
Assuming you're right, don't we have de novo review? And so whatever he did, we've got to take a look at it fresh and look at, if you're right, just at the allegations in the underlying complaint.
Correct. And in doing so, Your Honor, as we set forth in our brief and I've talked a bit about today, those allegations do not plead a viable claim against the Lions in their capacity as board members. And even if they did, those would be barred and therefore no duty to defend. Thank you.
Thank you to both counsel for your arguments in both cases. Very helpful, and we appreciate your responsiveness to our questions. Both cases will stand submitted. Opinions will issue in due course.